The law of dissonance. You see, internal pressure is the secret. So hold your breath, let's go deep, because when you really master the law of dissonance, your ability to persuade will skyrocket. You see, what happens is most of us feel more harmony in our lives when everything is consistent. Our jobs, our homes, our habits, even our soft drinks. This consistency is the glue that holds everything in our lives together. What that does, it allows us to cope with the world. Think of all the people you admire. I'll bet, by and large, most of them are consistent, congruent people. What they believe, what they say, and what they do, even when no one's watching, flow together seamlessly. Typically, a high degree of such consistency in one's life is indicative of personal and intellectual strength. People are more naturally inclined, even subconsciously, to gravitate toward and follow individuals who are consistent in their behavior. The converse is true. Inconsistency in one's personal and professional life is generally considered undesirable. The person whose beliefs, words, and deeds don't consistently match up is seen as hypocritical, two-faced, confused, or even mentally ill. So let's talk about this theory of cognitive dissonance. Part of this theory comes from Leon Festinger in 1957 at Stanford University. What he asserted was when attitudes conflict with actions, attitudes or beliefs, we are uncomfortable and motivated to try to change. His theory sets the foundation for the law of dissonance, one of the more important laws of magnetic persuasion. You see, the law of dissonance states that people will naturally act in a manner that is consistent with their cognitions. So your cognitions would be your beliefs, your attitudes, and your values. So when people behave in a manner that is inconsistent with these cognitions, they find themselves in a state of discomfort. Now, when they're in this uncomfortable state, they will naturally be inclined to adjust their behaviors or attitudes to regain mental and emotional consistency. When our beliefs, attitudes, and actions mesh, we live harmoniously. When they don't, we feel dissonance at some level. Now, this dissonance, let me explain it. It's kind of an awkward, uncomfortable, unsettled, disturbed, upset. Sometimes we get nervous or confused, and we don't like that feeling, and we need to get rid of it as soon as possible. So in order to eliminate or reduce such tension, we'll do everything and anything possible to change our attitude and our behavior, even if it means doing something we don't want to do. We'll change our beliefs, adjust our beliefs, amend our beliefs. Let me give you an example. Let's say your belief is stealing is wrong. That is your belief. Well, you're working in your home office, and your son or daughter comes down and says, "Isn't that stapler from work? Isn't that stealing?" Now, that would cause what we call a rubber band to stretch inside of you. That's dissonance. That's the tension. It stretches tighter and tighter. And you can't live with that because when it breaks or snaps, strange things start to happen. So the motivation to reduce the tension is what causes us to change or adjust or amend our beliefs. Most people will change their beliefs faster than they change their actions. Repeat that. Most people will adjust, amend, or change their beliefs much faster than they change their actions. We will do everything in our power to get back into balance. It's kind of this psycho-emotional stasis where we want everything to be equal. We want everything to be consistent. Now back to the stapler. You have a stapler there. They ask you if it's stealing. The rubber band stretches. Instead of admitting that you stole the stapler, it's easier to say, "Well, I do work at home," or "I'm just borrowing it for 20 years, or "they had too many staplers," or "they don't pay me enough." That is ways that we get past the dissonance. And we see this in our everyday life. So when your prospect, your patient, or customer believes that they make good decisions, or they believe they want to become financially independent, we have to get into these beliefs and these attitudes and understand exactly where dissonance can be used to persuade them. Now, on the flip side, if you stretch somebody's rubber band and it gets tighter and tighter and it snaps, they will usually come after you, maybe even attack you verbally. If somebody says, "Please help me with my diet," and you come home and they've just polished off 12 donuts, and you say, "Hey, wait a minute, the rubber band stretched, you better duck," because they're not going to own up to it most of the time. They will attack you. So we need to have this mental consistency. When we feel cognitive dissonance, we have to find a way to deal with this tension. So we have an arsenal of tools at our disposal to help us return to cognitive consistency. So I want to talk about a few of those ways that people do that. You really need to understand this as a persuader. Again, you're going to need to listen to this audio many times to really grasp this concept. But when you do, you become a student of human nature and you will become a great persuader. Let me give you another example first. Let's say you believe you should give back, you should help out in the community. You're watching TV late at night and there's a commercial with children in Africa or South America. They need your help. Your rubber band stretches because you're a good person. You want to help, but then maybe you change the channel. Or maybe you say, "Well, I've heard some of these charities really don't give back, so it might be a shady charity." Or you say, "Well, I already give to another charity, And I'm sure they give to those children too. Or you might just call up and give. There's a variety of different things that we do to handle that type of dissonance. So the first one is many people get what we call denial. So to shut out dissonance, you deny there's a problem. You don't have a problem. And you do this by either ignoring or demeaning the source or attacking the person, making it their fault. You might also deliberately misperceive the confronting position as far as the information is concerned. You might do what we call the modify. This is what you're looking for as a persuader, where you change your beliefs to achieve consistency. You know, you're right. I need to make a changes. I need your product or service. See, most of the time admits that they need to make a change in their life or they are wrong and they need to adjust some things to remedy their errors. Then there's the famous reframe. That's where you change your understanding or interpretation of the meaning. This leads you to either modify your thinking or to value the importance of the whole matter, considering it unimportant altogether. Then there's a search. I'm really good at this. So you're determined to find a flaw in the other side's position. You discredit them or you seek social validation or evidence to support your viewpoint. You might attempt to convince the source of their error. You might try to convince others that you did the right thing. Or the separation. You separate your attitudes that are in conflict. Or you what we call compartmentalize your cognitions, making it easier for you to ignore or even forget the discrepancy. Basically, what I do in this aspect of my life doesn't matter in this aspect of my life. Because in your mind, what happens in one area of your life should not affect the other areas of your life. Or, of course, rationalization, where you find excuses for why the inconsistency is acceptable. You change your expectations or try to alter what really happened. You also find reasons to justify your behavior or your opinions. For example, let's talk about smoking. Now, everyone's telling us that smoking's bad. There's studies, there's research, it's right on the cigarette package. So if somebody goes into a denial, they could say something like, well, I've been smoking for 20 years. I can quit any time. I'm not addicted. That's denial. Or if someone does the modify, you know what? I need to quit smoking. If I don't, it's going to kill me. Or there's a search. Well, my Uncle Fred smoked for 49, 59 years, and he lived to be 112. Or there's the reframe. Well, by the time I get cancer, if that ever happens, there'll be a cure. Or the separation. Well, if I quit smoking, I'll gain weight, and that'll be less healthy than smoking. Or the rationalization. Well, if I smoke mild cigarettes, then it's not as bad, and it has a filter. That reduces my risk. You see how this works? And you do this in every aspect of your life. So consider each one of these. Let me give you another example. Let's say your favorite politician, the local mayor, and you campaigned for them, you donated to them, you voted for them, but they're in big trouble. You spent all your time and money convincing family, friends, and neighbors to vote for this candidate. So your neck is on the line. You voted for this person. They became mayor, and they're now in trouble. You thought he was a family man, a man of value, someone that could be trusted. Now, after 2 years in office, he's been caught red-handed having an affair with an office staff member, barely older than his daughter. Now, what that does is create dissonance inside you. The rubber band stretches. You've told all these people to vote for this person. All of a sudden, something's gone wrong. What are you going to do? Well, I'll give you some options. If it was denial, you could say, well, you know, that's just the media going after him. He's doing a great job. The opposing party's trying to smear his good name. This will all blow over when the facts come out. It's just a big misunderstanding. Or there's the modify. You know, I can't believe I voted for this guy. I feel cheated and swindled. I feel taken advantage of. I really mistook him for a man of character. I need to apologize to my family and friends. I can't support a man who does not honor his wedding vows. Then the reframe. Well, the media said affair. Well, I'm not sure he didn't actually sleep with her. Maybe they're just good friends. I'm sure his wife knows about the whole thing. Even if they did have an affair, who does it? Is it that big of a deal? Or the search. Well, I heard about the reporter breaking the story. He's blown things out of proportion before. All the friends I've talked to don't think the story is true. In fact, the reporters hated this candidate from the beginning. I'm going to call that reporter right now. Separation. Well, I voted for him and he's doing a great job. Inflation is low, unemployment's not a problem, the crime's been reduced. He is doing everything he said he would. It does not matter what he does in his private life. What matters is how he's doing his job. There's no bearing between an affair and his job performance. Or the rationalization. Well, his wife is cold to him, and she's never around when he needs her. She's never really supported him since he took office. After all, she still has her own business. Maybe this is just a marriage of convenience, and this relationship's part of the agreement. So let me give you some more examples. What if you're a strict vegetarian, but you see a stylish leather jacket on sale? You try it on. It looks so good on you. That would trigger dissonance. You could not live with that. You would have to go through one of the six areas to reduce that dissonance. You're pro-life and your daughter has an abortion. You made a New Year's resolution to exercise every day and already halfway through February, but you have not been to the gym once. You're on a strict diet and you see Ben and Jerry's ice cream on sale at the grocery store. Stealing is wrong, but you just downloaded music off the internet. Buyer's remorse is also a form of dissonance. When we purchase a product or service, we tend to look for ways to convince ourselves that we made the right decision. If the people around us or outside influences make us question our decision, we experience buyer's remorse. On feeling this inconsistency, this tension, the rubber band stretching, we will look for anything. Facts, talk to our peers, social validation, expert opinion to reduce the dissonance in our minds concerning the purchase. Some of us even use selective exposure to minimize the risk of seeing or hearing something that could cause dissonance. Often people won't even tell family or friends about their purchase or decision because they know it will create dissonance. You see this all the time, people buying real estate packages for investing or joining network marketing companies or things that are really exciting to them. They, on purpose, will not tell their family and friends that they did it because they know that their family and friends will have negative feedback. They know their family and friends will spit on their dreams, and for many people, this causes dissonance or tension or uneasiness, and so rather than going through the stretched rubber band, they won't even tell them. So we need to maintain what we call that psychological consistency. We find what we seek. If we can't find it, we make it up. In politics, members of different parties will refuse to peaceably or tolerantly listen to opposing party commercials. They just won't watch the commercials. They won't listen to the commercials. Smokers won't read medical texts on the dangers of smoking. Drug users don't spend much time at the clinics. We don't want to find information that might oppose our current points of view. Now, there's an interesting study done by Knox and Inkster, and they found interesting results at a racetrack. They interviewed people waiting in line to place a bet, and then they questioned them after they'd placed a bet. They found that people were more confident with their decisions after they placed their bet than before the bet was made. They exuded greater confidence in their decisions and their chosen horses after the decisions were final and their bets were firmly made. Now, this is very important to understand because when you look at mindset, consumer mindset, before they do business with you, they're looking for every reason why they shouldn't. They're looking for flaws and mistakes. But once you've given them one reason why they should do business with you, now everything changes. They're looking for everything to validate that reason, every good reason why they should do business with you. That's critical to understand. Remember, trust is at an all-time low. People are more skeptical than ever before. Let me repeat that. I want you to grasp this. Before they do business with you, they're looking for every reason why they shouldn't. But once you've given them one great reason, in their mind, they've mentally committed to do business with you, then everything shifts. They're more confident. Now they're looking for everything to validate that decision. It's very important that you make that shift as a persuader. Another study done by Younger, Walker, and Arrowood decided to go to Canada at this exposition. And what they did is they interviewed people who had already placed bets at a variety of different games. Games of chance like bingo or Wheel of Fortune. So as these people were still on their way to place their bets, they were getting interviewed. And they were asked if they felt confident they were going to win. And the studies were the same as Knox and Inkster. The people who already made the bets felt luckier and more confident than those who had not placed their bets. You see, once we make the commitment of a bet or purchase a product or service, we feel more confident with ourselves and the choices we've made. This concept also holds true in persuasion and sales. Once a payment is given for your product or service, your prospects, your patients, your clients, your customers will usually feel more confident with their decisions. Have them make the payment or finalize the choice as soon as possible. Don't delay their decision. Get them to make a decision, even if it's a minor one. This will increase their confidence in their decision, and they will look for reasons to justify that decision. These studies show that to reduce dissonance, we often simply convince ourselves that we have made the right decision. We will feel better about our actions. Many times, even when we've made a bad decision, we become so entrenched in our belief that it was right and that we'll fight to the bitter end to prove it, even though deep down we know it was the wrong decision. You've seen this at family gatherings. Somebody said something stupid, spur of the moment. Everybody knew it was a lie or they were wrong, but they will fight to the bitter end to prove that they were right. That is dissonance. Remember, we can't handle the dissonance in our minds. So we find anything to prove our decision was right or to prove why you were wrong. So we become so embroiled in justifying our actions that we are willing to go down with the burning ship. When buying and selling shares of stocks, investors commonly stick with stocks that have recently slumped in price. There's no prospects of recovery. Now, on the rational side, the decision to cut their losses and invest elsewhere is a no-brainer. Irrationally, investors usually hang on and snarled by their initial decision. It was the right decision. It's going to turn around, and the stock keeps on plummeting. And this happened with McDonald's. See, there was these activists in London, and they were handing out a leaflet. It was entitled, "What's Wrong with McDonald's?" Now, the pamphlet asserted many claims that the food was unhealthy, the company exploited workers, they were destroying the rainforest, they were producing litter, they targeted children through advertising. So McDonald's was mad, that's not fair, they're hurting our feelings, and so they went after these activists for libel. Now, three of the activists backed down, but two of them went to court to fight McDonald's. And this case involved the longest court proceeding in the legal history of Britain. And it came to be considered the most expensive and disastrous public relations exercise ever mounted by a multinational company. Because what happened is the negative publicity went around the globe. 2 million copies were distributed. Remember the pamphlet, "What's Wrong with McDonald's?" All these things went into circulation. Then an internet site followed the case, received 7 million hits its first year. Having publicly asserted its stance that the company would challenge its antagonist, McDonald's was trapped. Forced to remain consistent to its position, McDonald's fought to the bitter end. This case took 2.5 years and cost McDonald's over $10 million to fight for five people handing out a pamphlet that very few people were reading anyway. Given the ramifications, perhaps it would have been better if the company had just cut their losses and moved on. So how do you use this dissonance? Remember, as we monitor great persuaders versus average persuaders at the Persuasion Institute, there's a big difference. Your role as a persuader is to help them persuade themselves. Create the dissonance so they can realize for themselves that they need to make a change and use your product or service. Dissonance is a powerful tool in helping others make and keep commitments. So there's this one study. Researchers staged a robbery to test the reactions of onlookers. So there's a beach near New York City. The researchers randomly selected an accomplice to place the beach towel down, about 5 feet away from somebody else, in a portable radio. And after relaxing there for a little while, the accomplice got up and left. See, here's the interesting part. After the accomplice had left, one of the researchers, pretending to be a thief, someone would call a confederate, in on the study, stole the radio, wondering how many people would risk personal harm to stop that thief. Well, as you imagine, hardly anyone reacted to the stage theft. In fact, very few people didn't want to put themselves at risk to confront the thief. In fact, only 20% went after the thief. Now, they kept doing this, and they did a minor alteration in the study, and it brought a huge difference in results. This time, before leaving, the accomplice asked the person sitting next to him, "Hey, could you please watch my things?" And the person, of course, said, "Well, sure, I can do that." This time, when the thief came and stole the radio, instead of 20%, 95% of the individuals sought to stop the thief by chasing, grabbing back the radio, in some case, even physically restraining him. Wow. Most people try to follow through when they promise they will do something, especially if it's in writing. This is why corporations sponsor writing contests about social issues or their products. They really don't care about your writing style. What they're really looking for is consumer endorsement. The writer puts down in his words what they think the company wants to hear about the product or service. Having made a written commitment to supporting and endorsing a product or issue, the consumer will now support the sponsoring company in their cause or be more willing to buy their product. In one study, they took 100 high school students and they were asked to write an essay on whether or not the voting age should be lowered. Half the students were told speeches would be published in the school newspaper, and the other half were told the essays would be kept confidential. After completing the essays, researchers exposed the students to a persuasive speech arguing that the voting age should not be lowered. Of the students assuming their papers were going to be published, very few of them changed their original position. Of the students who believed their students were confidential, most altered their stance on the issue to agree with the persuasive speech. And you see dissonance in marketing all the time. The bait and switch. If you can get someone to mentally commit to a product or decision, they are more likely to stay committed, even if the terms and conditions change. You see this when you're buying a car. And you see this in stores that advertise very low prices. For example, you see an advertisement for a television set, and it includes in small writing, "Quantities limited." By the time you get to the store, all the bargain televisions are sold, but you are mentally committed to buying a new TV. Well, wait, lucky for you, there are more expensive models available. So you go home having spent $300 more on a television set than you originally planned, just because you needed to maintain a consistency between your desire for a new TV and your action of being in the store. And sometimes you see this technique often used when goods and products go on sale. Another example, a customer may be lured into a store, buy an incredible deal on a nice pair of dress shoes. Then they inquire, and the disappointed customer learns from the salesperson that their size is not in stock. Just as the customer is about to leave, the salesperson miraculously comes with a similar pair, even though they found one this pair is not on sale. Remember I mentioned car dealerships? Think of a time when you purchased a new car. Have you ever noticed that when you're about to sign the contract, the price is $200 more than you expected? Well, someone forgot to tell you about the air conditioner or the mysterious undercoating that they put on the car. They just failed to inform you about some extras that the salesperson conveniently forgot to clear with their boss. You pay the extra $200 anyway because mentally you're committed to that car. You don't want to go through the whole hassle and headache of trying to renegotiate the deal. Often car dealers promise an incredible price, even a few hundred dollars below a competitor's price, all the while knowing it's not actually going to go through. The deal is offered only to motivate the buyer to purchase from their dealership. Once the customer decides to buy, the dealer sets up several conditions, each of them causing the customer to feel increasingly committed. Lengthy forms are filled out. Great lengths are set up to specific financing terms. The customer is encouraged to take the car home and drive it to work, run errands, to cruise the neighborhood. The dealer knows that while the customer is out joyriding, he or she is thinking of all the many reasons their purchase is justified. These techniques are often used when high school students and their parents are narrowing down colleges they should attend. Just like car dealers, colleges often give a low estimate on your cost. It's not until after you've signed up and registered you discover your actual costs. Brand loyalty is also a form of dissonance. You see, it's a challenge getting customers to remain loyal to a particular product. Unlike the good old days when brand loyalty stood for something, times have changed. As a society, we no longer feel compelled to stick with a certain company or product. I grew up with Crest, Cheerios, and Tide being staples in my house. Now I buy whatever brands I feel like. I'm not likely to remain loyal to a brand unless they reward me for my commitment to them. For example, frequent flyer miles, little cards you get when you buy gas at a certain gas station, or the bumper sticker you put on. You see, acquiring customer loyalty is the reason the tobacco industry spends over $600 million giving away paraphernalia with tobacco logos. We constantly see companies putting their logos on coffee mugs, t-shirts, pens, and mouse pads. Even though you might not have paid for these items, owning them creates loyalty to the product advertised on them. Most people don't wear a Budweiser t-shirt if they drink Coors beer. One of the goals with dissonance is to get public commitments. Public commitments and dissonance go hand in hand. Even when we feel an action is not right, we still go through with it if we publicly committed to such a course of action. Let me just give you an example here. Weddings are psychologically binding. When you ask a young lady to marry you, she says yes. Commitment. Announcement of the engagement. Commitment. Okay. Telling your friends. Commitment. Getting the rings. Commitment. Asking the parents. Commitment. Setting the date. Taking the pictures. Sending the announcements. Paying the deposit. Commitment. 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 Each step closer to I do results in greater level of commitment. Even if the couple decides they want to call it off, it actually feels easier to go through with the wedding than to stop the whole process created by so much public commitment. The more public our stand, the more reluctant we are to change it. A now famous experiment proves this principle. A group of students were divided into three groups. Each group viewed some lines and had to estimate their length. The students in the first group had to privately write down estimates, sign their names to it, and hand it in. The second group of students had to privately write down their estimates, but they did so on a magic writing pad. They could lift the plastic cover on their notepad, and their figures would instantaneously disappear. The third group of students did not write down their estimates at all. They just kept it in their minds. Now, it didn't surprise anybody to find out that when the new information was presented contradicting their estimates, the students had written down their estimates, signed their names to them, and handed them in, remained the most committed to their choices. While those who had never committed anything in writing most readily swayed to change their responses. Often procedures, customs, traditions are specifically established for the purpose of creating psychological commitment. Fraternity initiations, military boot camps, political rallies, protest marches, and demonstrations. When we make our vows, beliefs, and statements or endeavors public, we feel more bound to them. We can back out on commitments and claims we've made in public, but we pay a psychological and emotional price. What's more, the public we made those commitments to, the greater the emotional price tag will be. The researchers Elliot Aronson and Judson Mills claim that persons who go through a great deal of trouble or pain to attain something tend to value it more highly than persons who attain the same thing with a minimum of effort. Additional research confirmed their assertion when co-eds who were required to endure pain rather than embarrassment to get into a group desired membership more than their counterparts. In one particular case, the more pain one young woman endured as part of her initiation, The more she later tried to convince herself, her new group and its activities were interesting, intelligent, and desirable. Another study of 54 tribal cultures found that those with the most dramatic initiation rituals also had the most unity and commitment. It was also determined that these groups oppose any attempts to undermine or destroy these customs, which render so much strength to their tribe and their culture. Understanding the psychology of commitment through publicity can be used to bring about good societal changes. See, most organizations exist to help individuals conquer bad habits, patterns, or abuses. For example, weight loss centers commonly encourage clients to share their goals with as many friends, relatives, and neighbors as they can, understanding that this public commitment and pressure often works when the other methods don't. An experiment conducted by Palak used an interviewer who offered free energy-saving hints to natural gas users. The residents who agreed to try to conserve energy would have their names publicized in the newspaper articles as fuel-conserving citizens. The effect was amazing. It was immediate. 1 month later, when the utility companies checked their meters, the homeowners in the publication sample had saved an average of 422 cubic feet of natural gas apiece. That's a lot. The chance to have their names in the paper had motivated these residents to put forth substantial conservation efforts for a period of 1 month. Even during the months when their names weren't in the paper, the families continued to conserve gas. They saved 12.2% in the first month because they expected to see their names displayed in the newspaper. When a letter went out stating their names would no longer be printed in the paper, the families did not return to their previous wasteful energy uses as expected. Rather, they continued to conserve energy. One of my favorite aspects of dissonance is what we call FITD, or foot in the door. What this does is it urges people to remain consistent with their commitments. This is how it works. Even if someone begins with a small request and follows up with a larger request, we still tend to remain consistent in our behavior and answers. This technique of capitalizing on such a principle has been called by several names: foot in the door, self-perception, sequential request. Basically, it's a means of using a person's self-perception to motivate them to partake of the desired action. When an individual complies the first time, they perceive themselves as helpful. If they're asked to comply a second time, in even a greater way, they are likely to consent. In an effort to maintain consistency with the first impression, with their own self-perception, they agree to give even more of themselves. So here's the key when you're getting commitments. Remember, our belief is that we keep commitments. You want to get as many commitments as you can throughout your presentation. Get as many yeses as you can, but start out small. Small commitments often lead to large commitments. For example, a salesperson often focuses first on securing an initial order, even if it's a small one. Once this is accomplished, the customer will be more likely to commit to buying from them again. Written commitments are usually more powerful than verbal commitments. We know the power of the written word. When contracts are signed and promises put in writing, the commitment level correspondingly increases tenfold. Then you want to make them public. We know that public commitments are stronger than private commitments. Taking a public stand that is witnessed by other people is important. Otherwise, if we go against that public commitment, we risk being seen as inconsistent, weak, or dishonest. Here's an example. Weight loss centers, like we talked about before, they have their clients write down their goals, share the goals with as many people as possible, thereby decreasing the likelihood of failure. Understand the key to FITD, foot in the door, is to get the person to initially grant a small request. For example, if you were to ask someone, "Can I have 30 seconds of your time?" Most people would respond, "Yes." The second step in the FITD is making another more involved request. "Can I try this out on the stain in your carpet?" The person feels he should consent to the second request because he is that kind of person. He's already seen himself do other behaviors in support of the product or service. So usually they willingly comply with the second request. There's some studies done by Friedman and Fraser that kind of highlights FITD. So what they did in their study is they had researchers in a California neighborhood, and they were asking residents if they would allow a large billboard reading "Drive carefully" to be displayed in their front lawns. So they'd have an idea of what it would look like. They showed the potential recruits a picture of a large, ugly sign obstructing the view of a beautiful house. Now, naturally, most people refused. But in one study, actually 76% consented. They used the foot in the door. This is what happened. 2 weeks prior, these residents had been approached by another volunteer and asked them to make a small commitment to display a 3-inch square sign that said, "Be a safe driver." And had just put it in their windows. Very simple, very small. Since it was such a small and simple request, nearly all of them agreed. The astounding results were that the initial small commitment profoundly influenced their willingness to comply with a much larger quest 2 weeks later. Now, Friedman and Fraser were also interested in discovering whether or not they could persuade homeowners to carry out a very large request. They went to the house and they asked if they would permit a group of 5 or 6 unknown men to freely look through their cupboards and storage spaces for 2 hours under the premise they would be classifying all the household products. Pretty invasive. Prior to this request, however, researchers had asked some of the homeowners to take a survey about household products. Of those surveyed, approximately 50% consented, allowing the men to go through their household products. Of the homeowners who had not been surveyed, only 25% agreed to let the men examine the storage spaces. Let me give you another great example. Another study involved testing to see if introductory psychology students would rise early to take part in a 7 a.m. study. And this study was about thinking processes. For one group, the students were called and told up front the session would begin promptly at 7 a.m. Of these students, only 24% agreed to participate. The second group, using foot in the door, the students were first told about the study and would they like to participate. The 7 o'clock a.m. time was not mentioned until after they consented to take part. And when they divided it up, multiple questions, the compliance rate went from 24% to 56%. When the opportunity to change their minds was presented to them, however, none of them took advantage of it. 95% of the students actually followed through and showed up for the 7 a.m. session. In another case, a social psychologist, Stephen Sherman, wanted to see if he could increase the number of people that would be willing to collect door-to-door donations for the American Cancer Society. He started calling residents and would just ask them what the response would be if they were asked to volunteer 3 hours of their time to collect charitable donations for the American Cancer Society. Well, of course, not wanting to seem uncharitable, many responded that they would indeed volunteer. Well, what's the final outcome? Well, when a representative of the American Cancer Society actually called and asked for volunteers, get this, hope you're sitting down, there was over 700% increase in the individuals agreeing to participate. So how do we use FITD effectively? Well, when utilizing this technique, you must first determine exactly what end result you are seeking. What is the big commitment you're going to ask for? You will then create several small questions and small commitments and simple requests along that path that are related to your ultimate request, making sure they can be easily satisfied, making sure it's easy to say yes. When you take these measures, it'll increase your likelihood that your ultimate request will be granted. But remember these points. The first request, the first thing you're asking them to do, needs to be of sufficient size for the foot in the door technique to work. But on the other hand, it cannot be so big that it seems inappropriate and is not easily and readily accomplished. So basically, you want to present the largest possible request that will still realistically be accepted most of the time. And you need to get in their shoes. What is your prospect's viewpoint? This technique is not effective if your prospect senses you are acting in your own self-interest instead of their best interest or society's best interest. What's in it for you? Why are you requesting it for them? What do you get out of it is constantly on their mind. And always look at external incentives. The FITD technique loses impact if your prospect is offered external incentives for agreeing to your first request. Researchers typically use self-perception theory to explain this phenomenon. Let me just give you an example so you can understand this. If you are given a gift for listening to a salesperson, you will not consciously or subconsciously perceive yourself to be one who is willing to readily listen and agree to the salesperson's offer. Instead, you agree to listen only for the incentive being offered. And also realize the source of the request. When using FITD and you're using different people for the initial and subsequent requests can be effective. This way, the same person isn't required to make both the initial and follow-up requests, and your prospects won't feel like they're being taken advantage of or backed into a corner. So again, you can use different people for the different requests. So let me talk about some of the steps to creating dissonance. Now, this assumes you already know what their cognitions are, what their beliefs, their attitudes, and their values are. Now, remember, great persuaders ask 3 times more questions than average persuaders, so you know exactly where they're coming from. So with that in mind, the first thing you want to do is get a commitment. You can create or reveal commitments in your prospects by ensuring that the commitments are public, affirmative, voluntary, and effortful. Let me explain. So when you're getting commitments, can you make it public? Make your prospect stand as public as possible. Can you get it written down? Can you involve friends and neighbors and family? Engage your customer in public handshake to seal the deal in front of other employees and customers. Make it as public as possible. And make it affirmative. You want to get as many yes answers as possible because yes has developed consistency within the person that will carry over into your major request. Now, This technique reduces dissonance and makes it easier for prospects to say yes to your final proposal. Even if it's watered down, getting yeses to any request makes it easier to invoke the same response down the road. Close with a series of questions, ideally 6 questions, that all end with yes. Desire increases with each yes and decreases with each no. Every time we say yes to a benefit, our desire goes up. Make it voluntary. When getting commitments, start small and build up to larger commitments later. You cannot force commitments. Long-term approval has to feel like it comes from your prospect's will, something they want to do or say. They have to volunteer to test drive the car or to write the contract or request more information. When they make a commitment, you can make the action more voluntary and solidify the commitment by saying things like, "Are you serious? Do you really mean that? Are you not just pulling my leg, are you?" Again, voluntary. Last step, make it effortful. The more effort your prospects exert in making the commitment, the more it seals the deal. You don't want to ask a prospect to do something extreme, but you do want them to exert extra effort. Remember when I talked about the car dealer? Car dealers often offer a great deal on a car just to get people in the lot. The prospect then makes a commitment to come in and look at the car only to find that it's already been sold. Already committed to being there, they browse a lot and find another car they like. They start to fill out the paperwork, talking terms, completing forms. These are all small commitments that later lead to full commitments. Many times, the car dealer will continue obtaining these small commitments only to come back and say he can only give $2,000 for the trade-in instead of $2,500 like he promised. At this point, the buyer has exerted so much effort and has created so many small commitments that an extra $500 won't break the deal. The next step is to create dissonance. Maybe you want to stretch the rubber band a little bit. Once you have the commitment, you can create the dissonance. You create that dissonance or imbalance by showing your prospects they have not kept or not keeping their commitment. For example, "Well, you told me you're on a strict diet. Why did you buy a dozen donuts?" "Well, you'd mentioned you want to become financially independent, but if you stay on track where you're working for the next 20 years, will you be able to retire wealthy?" The person's self-image is squeezed from both sides by consistency pressures. The prospect feels great internal pressure to bring self-image in line with action. At the same time, there is pressure from the outside to adjust this image according to the way others perceive us. Then, of course, what you need to do is, you're not stretching the rubber band for fun, is you're offering a solution. A great persuader can create dissonance, but you need to offer a way out. You need to show, prove, or explain how your product, service, or idea can reduce their distance that your prospect is feeling. For example, if you donate right now, you can continue to feed the homeless children in Africa. Keep in mind that the final solution or major request is what you ultimately want to accomplish. As you prepare your whole persuasive presentation around the moment when you will ask for the major request, once your prospects accept the solution, they have convinced themselves that they have made the right and only choice. As a result, they feel great about their decision. This makes the cognitive dissonance disappear. The decision was their own personal choice, and they have solved the dilemma in their own minds. They know exactly what they need to do. The solution is your call to action. Okay, take a breath. We went deep with dissonance. You might want to review this audio time and time again. This is a foundational principle of human behavior. When you understand dissonance, and when you can see your prospect, your patient, your client, or your customer with the rubber band stretching, you know what path to take them. Because if you do or say the wrong thing, they might go off the other direction. You know that prospect. They needed, they wanted, they liked it. Everything was perfect about your product or service. They were going to do it, and they never came back. They came up with some strange excuse. They needed more referrals. It's because you didn't handle the stretched rubber band in the right way. Master dissonance, and you will master your future.